BGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 478, recorded on September 17th, 2017. Welcome to the 278th edition of the TD Game Podcast and the 311th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Denzer.
And I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and a gaming flashback. So, I'm doing something really strange right now. I am watching on ESPN2 the Injustice 2 Finals. This is the only time I remember that I saw something like this on ESPN2. I know they did some esports thing like a few years ago, and just even I think it was Dota, or League of Legends, and the regular ESPN announcers were confused why this would be on a sports channel. So this could be the harbinger of things to come, really, because I can just picture ESPN having something like StarCraft 2. Although I will say, doing something like Injustice 2 makes the most sense because everybody knows DC Comics, and everybody can tell what's going on in a fighting game. And even if they don't know the button presses to use, it still looks cool.
Yeah. And earlier this year, I mentioned this when you brought this up to me earlier, they were actually doing the Street Fighter V finals on ESPN. It was, I think, last year that ESPN actually developed a actual department for esports coverage, and they are following it now. They had the Street Fighter V finals on earlier this year, and when you brought Injustice up to me, I was thrilled about that, because Injustice 2 is a much better game than Street Fighter V. I'm happy to see that Injustice 2 is getting that kind of coverage.
Apparently it's in my neighborhood, and I didn't even know about it. this one guy is using Catwoman, and he has this habit of lagging behind and all of a sudden making this furious comeback. It's almost like he's learning his opponent's moves, then reacting. Something like that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. To watch. And that's impressive too, because Catwoman has, since the game launch, been considered to be a lower tier character among competitors. So this is the kind of stuff, like when a pro comes out with this and takes a what is considered by a lot of people to be a lower level character and just rule the leaderboard with them. It's the kind of thing that shakes up the whole scene, and everybody tries to figure out what that guy was doing and how he made it work so well.
So now he's fighting against Sonic Fox, and Sonic Fox was on, and he's undefeated so far in this championship. This is the final fight. And I forgot which character that he uses. It would be funny if they both use Catwoman, actually. Speaking of Injustice 2, I might as well bring up the fact that I downloaded the Black Manta character for Injustice 2. And I will say, even in my hands, he seems a bit OP. He can juggle like nothing else. He can just kick people in the air. Actually, he stabs them into the air, and he just keeps them up there for a while. He is very powerful. It'll be interesting to see. I haven't checked the reactions on his character yet. I do like some of his interactions, especially when he's facing against Atrocitus. They have some very interesting things to say to each other.
Yeah.
Obviously, he has interesting things to say to Aquaman, but that's neither here nor there. We already know that they hate each other. It's sort of like Atrocitus is insisting, well, you know, you have rage inside you that you need to let out, and Black Manta's laughing at him and says, you know, whatever you say, I don't really care. you haven't tried him, have you?
No, but you bring up Atrocitus and the juggling, and for me personally, I'm an Atrocitus main for that exact reason. Atrocitus has a lot of different skills that keep opponents in the air and move them around for a while. His blood tornado is one of the best engages for a combo, and that is how I crush opponents, is just by catching them and moving them around, hitting them with overheads, and then going into that blood tornado and just like going after a horrible, horrible, ridiculously frustrating combo that'll keep them in the air for a long time. So Black Manta sounds up my alley.
Speaking of which, Sonic Fox is using Red Hood. That's who I saw him using before. So it'll be Red Hood versus Catwoman.
That's interesting, because when I played Red Hood, like, he's quirky, but, like, man, I really did not like the gimmicks that he had. He kind of annoyed me with what he had going on.
The thing is that this guy, Sonic Fox, is undefeated with him so far in the tournament using Red Hood. That's interesting. What's interesting to me is that they don't adjust their characters. It seems like they have to pick one character, and they have to use that character the entire tournament. They don't have any choice of changing, you know. Which you're able to do with other games, especially in MOBAs, you know, in which you will build your team and react to what the other people are using. This, no, you better have your one character and boom, go with it. So if you're in the contest, say, you'd probably be forced to use Atrocitus every single match.
That's interesting, too, because in a lot of fighting games, you see someone go main on a certain character for a long time. Cobra is a huge Zangief main, and every once in a while, they'll bust out a character like Cammy in Street Fighter and change it up just to keep opponents on their toes. I don't know if every tournament works on the same rules, but it's interesting to see when a character just busts out someone they don't use on a regular basis.
And, you know, the thing about this is that it is fit for TV. Watching it, you know, it's like I said, it's easy to grasp because you have DC characters fighting against each other. One thing I'm wondering is how they're going to implement the Atom, because we know it's going to be the Atom. We see his shadow in the damn thing. It's impossible for him to be anything else because they make him 2 inches tall in the portrait.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, Scott, what have you been playing?
I've been playing Ease or Wise or I'm just going to say Wise, yeah. Which is better.
E6,
anyways,
was it? No, it's
I don't care how it's
was
pronounced.
It number seven?
I'm just going to say Wise. And
is it number seven or?
Well, I haven't played that one yet. I'm going through the whole series.
Oh, playing you're starting with Ease 1. Okay.
Yeah, and 1 seems to be pretty short, so I guess 2 will be just as short. You can get through it if you know. I guess if you have the time, you can get through it in one sitting. So I'm just kind of blazing through it. I don't really like the bump mechanic, so when they did it differently in part 3, where you're side scrolling, you use your sword and stuff, that seemed to upset people a lot when they changed their standard mechanic, and they went back to it with Oath of Fel'Ghanna or whatever, however, you know, for the reimagining of it. So, like I said, I'm replaying the series, going through it, and right now I'm on the first one, almost done with that one. It had some tough bosses, where this bat boss, it goes into a bat form, and it's invulnerable, and you have to wait for it to go back to a solid form, and it's only in that solid form for, like, less than a second, and you have to hit it in that small time window to do damage, and that was a pain in the ass.
Hmm.
And like I said, the first one, you get to see how Adol's journey starts. His first venture, he meets Doki, and he has to conquer this Tower of Darm, and I think restore the goddesses to Wise, and restore balance to the land, because it's a really messed up place that he's in, where there's this storm wall surrounding the area, and there's monsters swarming the place. So, like I said, he has to restore balance, and that's in the first game. And I know Wise 8 has been delayed due to they're fixing some bugs, which I always enjoy when they don't rush a product out and they're like, no, we've got issues to fix, and they're holding off on releasing it until they're done fixing it. So that's good.
I mean, keep in mind, Wise 8, Lacrimosa of Dawn was already released. They're talking about the PC version that they're mm-hmm. delaying.
Yeah.
So what have you been playing, TJ?
So I've mostly been on Destiny 2. I have actually missed out on a lot of the events this last weekend. I'm not in a hurry to get through the game, so I've sort of been taking my time. I haven't beaten the main story yet, even though I'm sort of on the cusp. I'm still enjoying it. I made a pretty badass warlock. I'm enjoying my time in the. I'm playing a lot of PvP lately. Player versus player.
Is the warlock the melee character?
The warlock is a lot of area of effect okay. Moot. They bust out. They have a lot of grenades that are area of effect. Their super is a lot of different like sweeping moves or stuff that's built to take out a group all at once.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think they have control, crowd control?
Yeah, the warlock is meant to be a lot of crowd control. That's the idea behind them.
But I mean stuff like mezzing, you know.
Well, one of the big things about the warlock is like dropping a grenade that pulls people into one spot. Going and once everybody is gathering, just like gathered into one place, just taking them all out at once.
Oh, I'm thinking about the dynamite from Left 4 Dead 2 now, or Left 4 Dead period.
And the other big thing behind the warlock is they can drop a field that will either heal everyone who steps into it or up their weapon damage. And I've been rocking the weapon damage version of that a lot lately, especially when it comes to PvP. I got my hands on an exotic pulse rifle called the Vigilance Wing, which is a normal pulse rifle will throw out 3 bullets per burst. The Vigilance Wing throws out 5, and it gets bonuses to the warlock. It gets bonuses to the character. You heal if one of your teammates takes damage. So it's a fantastic gun for PvP, and especially a fantastic gun if you're in a group when you're taking on any given challenge. Call me a flip flopper here. I'm having a good time with Destiny 2 so far. I know a lot of people have had similar complaints about it doing the same things that it did in Destiny 1, which I can see that. Like, when I got to the point in the game where you fight these dudes called the Vex, which are basically robot Terminator hive mind enemies, I kind of snored a bit because I hate the Vex. I think they're boring. I think they're essentially the zombie character of robot enemies, and I can't stand them. They're super boring compared to everyone else. But as far as, like, the planets, just, like, exploring, the missions, everything is beautiful. Everything is more engaging. I'm having a good time.
Right now, Red Hood is kicking Catwoman's ass. Anyways, as for me, I broke down. I got the expansion XCOM 2, War of the Chosen. Is that what it's called? War of the Chosen, I think?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So here's the thing is that... I like it, and I defeated the 3 Chosen, but by the time I got to the 3rd Chosen, I absolutely wiped the map with them. Here's the thing, the last Chosen mission, not only did I not get anybody hurt, but I didn't allow anybody to even take a fire at me. The stat for most fired upon is nobody. Nobody on my team was fired at. Much less hurt. That's how fast we took them out. So yeah, I mean, it's fun, and I don't mind it. You know, it's a struggle because when my first semi playthrough, I wasn't familiar with the mechanics of using the chosen factions to do stuff, and now I do. And having soldiers bond together, I was hoping they would actually get married. Or what's it called, have that thing. No, they just get the bond level 3, so they're not even dating. They're just really bro dudes. I wanted to see them fall in love. I will say that if one of the characters of a bond get killed during a match, the other character goes berserk, which means they attack repeatedly in one turn. But after that, it's like, oh, well, sucks to be them. I'm without a bond now. I was hoping for something a little more in-depth.
Hmm.
Otherwise, I'm getting used to some of the powers of the 3 leaders. And it's, you know, it's worth the $40. It adds a lot of content. I've also been playing a lot of the Diner Dash sequel. Oh, damn, I forgot the name of it. Hold on, Cooking Dash. And here's the thing. Cooking Dash may be a free-to-play microtransactions, but they do their – I think I said this last week. They do their microtransactions so cunningly. If you want 10 gold, which is the premium currency, you just spend 99 cents. Or if you want 35 gold, you spend $3. And it's small, but here's the thing. It makes it a lot easier for you to start shelling out money dollar at a time. So it's And I can make that gold very slowly doing other things, but at some point I just say, screw it, here's a dollar, just give me the 10 gold so I can complete this thing. So it's insidious. And I wouldn't say I feel like I'm being ripped off, because it does it in such a way that you feel like, yeah, it's, you know, it's a soft sell. This past weekend they've had all your matches are free. Usually it costs groceries, but all of them cost no groceries. So you're able to keep playing and playing and playing and playing for the weekend, which is insidious, because now you might end up spending more gold, because all you're making, you know, I mean, you can earn other stuff by waiting, but you know how people are. They don't want to wait.
Yeah.
So I'm having fun, a lot of fun with cooking. And that's the other thing, is that there is a metric crap ton of content. I mean, content upon content upon content. There's like 40 restaurants, and each restaurant has two or three different types of things that they do. For example, the first restaurant is something called Table Steaks. And inside it, it also has two more restaurants with completely different food using the same setup. And each of the new restaurants that are apart from that, like I went for the pastry thing. And basically it has you having conveyor belts instead of going and mixing the food. Now you're putting mixing things on the conveyor belts and having to hit each switch, you know? Hmm. Then I regret doing Adventure Eats, if only because of the content. In that one, you're freezing and broiling spiders and slugs and brains and stuff like that to make food. So I'm serving people fried brains, deep fried brains, and chocolate covered scorpions. You know, it's a strange level. So I have several. Restaurants now. I already aced the entirety of the first one, Table Steaks. Because you have star levels, but you also have star plus for if you get 5 stars and you serve every customer. And I did that for the first one, all of them. So, but there's so much content there that, you know, but I still, here's the problem, is that I like the food in that first one. You can still replay them and earn gold that way, but you can't get the bonus of getting 5 stars. That's only a one-time deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a little gold hat on that restaurant. So yeah, I mean, Cooking Dash is really, really good. If I will say this though, don't get it on a cell phone. Don't get it on an Android. Don't get it on an iPhone. Get it on an iPad, because it's one of those things which you have to tap parts of the screen, and sometimes you can, you know, it takes. Oh, I didn't mean to tap that. So yeah, get a large screen for that game, and it's strangely addictive. Well, not strangely. I mean, I've always enjoyed Diner Dash from the very beginning. So, that's what I've been playing. Anyways, we're going to move on to Gaming Flashback. And the Gaming Flashback, take it away, TJ.
Gaming Flashback, Mass Effect. Mass Effect is an action role-playing video game developed by BioWare and originally released for the Xbox 360 video game console in 2007. It is the first game of the Mass Effect series, taking place within the Milky Way galaxy in the year 2183. The player assumes the role of Commander Shepard, an elite human soldier who must stop a rogue agent from opening a portal for a highly advanced machine race of synthetic organic starships that are believed to eradicate all organic civilizations every 50,000 years. The gameplay requires the player to explore a galaxy map to find and complete quests. Most of the game's main quests are combat missions, while secondary quests generally involve the player gathering items or interacting with non-player characters. Planned as the first chapter of a trilogy from the very beginning, Mass Effect was developed over the course of 3.5 years and uses the Unreal Engine 3 as a groundwork. It was designed so the player would assume the role of a central character that could make important decisions and impact the story of the game in numerous ways. The combat was designed to offer the tactics and customization of a role-playing game, but through a simpler and real-time third-person shooter interface. During conversations with characters, Mass Effect employs a radial command menu called Dialogue Wheel, where the player's dialogue options depend on wheel direction. The left side of the wheel is normally reserved for options that will continue the conversation in depth, while the options on the right side tend to move the conversation towards completion. Responses at the top are generally more polite and selfless, while those at the bottom are more aggressive and hostile. Dialogue choices impact how other characters react to Shepard and affect the player's chosen morality. Morality is measured by Paragon, or Charm, and Renegade, Intimidation, points. These points allow the player to develop talents that affect the availability of new Paragon and Renegade dialogue options with significant impact in the game. Mass Effect features two downloadable content packs. The first pack, Bring Down the Sky, was released as a paid download for Xbox 360 on March 10, 2008, and as a free download for Microsoft Windows on May 28, 2008. The second pack, Pinnacle Station, was released as a paid download for the Xbox 360 and as a free download on Microsoft Windows on August 25th, 2009. However, it remains absent on the PlayStation 3 version of the game.
And I have to add that it also has what is now the most iconic video game music of all time. I mean, I could play a clip right here, pretend you hear it, and it's like, oh, yeah, Mass Effect. And it really is stirring. Most memorable music comes from Mass Effect 2. But I remember playing the shit out of Mass Effect over and over and over. From 2007 to 2010, I must have logged 500 hours on Mass Effect just going through all the options. And we all nicknamed Renegade Shepard as Colossal Dickosaurus, if you remember.
When I played this game, like, it was Mass Effect 2 was about to come out, and my buddy told me, you got to play through the first one. You got to see what happens. You got to get your character from the first game to the second game. And so I played a character on the first Mass Effect, and to be honest, I had already played an hour of Mass Effect 2, and I kind of hated it at first. It was methodical compared to the action pacing of Mass Effect 2.
Yeah, we have to mention that the combat in Mass Effect 1 was pretty piss poor. I will say that, you know, my Shepard ended up only using a pistol because that's all he needed.
Mm-hmm. I was a sniper type when I played Mass Effect 1, and I remember just like, man, exploring planets. They were this is a lot of people's general complaint about the first game, is that driving around in that Mako was like the most upsetting and boring and annoying part of that game, just because like that gunship controlled so poorly that it was so frustrating.
You know, but the thing is that I hated the Hammerhead because it took three shots and would explode. At least the Mako could take a few shots, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's trying to get through.
The exploration was horrible. Yeah, the exploration was horrible. And all the planets were palette swaps except for the key planets.
So the combat was terrible. Exploration is terrible. The Renegade and Virtue thing is boring. So what made people want to play this game and continue through all three games?
Because so the Virtue and Paragon. So the Virtue and Paragon thing actually wasn't that bad. The strength of the first Mass Effect game was in the storytelling. The interaction with the characters, being on the ground and talking to people and exploring and investigating the missions, that's where this game succeeded. That's where it told a great story. BioWare crafted a fantastic narrative with the first game.
And all of the characters were memorable. You remember Rex, you remember Tali, you remember Garrus. You know, you remember Ashley, all of them. And, you know, here's the thing. A lot of people really had a lot of pathos over the Vermeier mission because that's where you had to choose either Ashley or Caden would live. I never really had that problem. I mean, but I know a lot of people did. And the biggest thing, however, was the fact that when you played Mass Effect 2 and you imported your save file, every single decision, no matter how minuscule you made in the first game, was reflected in the next game. Like Helena Blake. Now, Helena Blake was a crime boss, an older woman, who you confronted. And depending on how you dealt with her, She reappears in the second game, provided you don't kill her. And if you convinced her to be good, you know, and to quit being a crime boss, she appeared in Omega as a social worker who dealt with people that normal people wouldn't deal with because they're like criminals. But, you know, since she was a criminal, she knows how to deal with them. If you let her go and let her continue her criminal organization, she was an underboss for Aria at Omega. So, and everything you said, that would be reflected as well. It's sort of like after playing Mass Effect 2, when you went back to Mass Effect 1, you paid a lot closer attention to what you were doing because you knew, holy crap, everything I did was indeed remembered. I mean, Mass Effect 2 made Mass Effect 1 that much better. And also, I will say this, it is the rare game. You have Fallout as one example in which you could talk the bad guy to death. In that one, you could convince Saren, you know, you're indoctrinated and you have no free will anymore, and he would use all the last of his free will to shoot himself. And I read the book, and he was a complete and utter bastard in the book. In the game, I think, subverted the book by making him – well, there's a reason why he was a Spectre and the reason why people liked him, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's an important choice in the actual game is that Saren was a Spectre for a reason. He was supposed to be – every one of these people is supposed to be a instrument of justice for the Citadel to a certain degree.
Except for poor Nihilus who's going to be your Obi-Wan and then shot in the back 5 minutes into the game.
Yeah. But like even to a certain degree, there had to be some redeeming qualities of Saren. And I think having that choice at the end – to like talk him down to a certain position is an important character. Like BioWare knew what they were doing when they made that game. It is one of the better, I think, BioWare narratives to have ever been written. If it wasn't for that narrative, you're right, Scott. I don't think I would have bothered. I don't think I would have been able to plod through that level of combat and that exploration. But it was because I wanted to see what happened next that kept me going.
And the thing is that the choices you made had in the game itself had a lot of changes. Sometimes you just play differently just to see what would happen, you know? And I will say the Ultimate Renegade ending gives me chills. It is as vicious as the Dark Side ending for KOTOR. It is that bad. It's sort of like, whoa, Shepard is a villain here. He's not a renegade. He's an out and out villain there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that, you know, a lot of people were surprised at the subtlety, though. When you did a renegade choice, it wasn't me bad, you die. No, it was that Paragon Shepard believed that you didn't need to compromise your morals to get what you wanted. Well, renegade Shepard was the ends justify the means, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, renegade Shepard also said, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know? It reminded me of what it should have been in the Jade Empire. Remember, the Order of Closed Fist was supposed to be, you know, you're responsible for your own and, you know, but it ended up being evil choices in that game. Here, it's actually, you're not doing evil choices, you're doing hard, I don't care choices. You're actually, and here's the thing, the more renegade choices you made, the more in second game, more your eyes glowed and all that stuff, until you start realizing, wait a minute, you're turning into Saren. Being a renegade shepherd was actually being Saren.
Yeah. And like, BioWare fixed a there was one thing I hated about Jade Empire, and it was something that they fixed in Mass Effect. If you tried to be neutral in Jade Empire, you were punished for it. There's two higher tier martial arts abilities that come out of being either too good or too bad in Jade Empire. And if you try to be neutral, then you lose out on both of them.
You know, I never used those abilities, though. I mean, the stone – what was it? What's it called? Something about stone, and the other one was – and the characters you meet are playing chess game in their heads. Not chess, but go, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Neither ability. It was just, oh, well, I get the Jade Golem, that's it, game over. Jade Golem, you just pound them. Just one pound, doom, battle over, I win.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think I missed out on it because I let the supposedly quote-unquote evil guy fight the last battle for me. Or not the last battle, but there was a battle that he wanted to fight because it was personal to him. So I let him fight it, and I think I missed out on the ability because of it, because I was supposed to take that fight, but I felt morally that that was the acceptable choice, but I guess the game didn't.
Yeah, and I'm salty about Jade Empire for that one thing. Like, I don't know what those two those two higher tier abilities are, because I never got them because I was neutral, and I was so salty about it that I stopped playing the game at that point.
I love Jade Empire. I mean, the big twist in Jade Empire is the best twist that you never saw coming. But when you played again and you paid special attention, you say, yeah, actually, yeah, that twist is actually – they were giving us the details of the twist without us knowing it, with being very subtle.
There were several characters that noticed that there was something wrong with
your
fighting style.
But it's not only that, but the decisions that who ends up being the bad guy does near the beginning of the game. We're not going to spoil – I refuse to spoil this because, you know what? There may be someone out there who hasn't played Jade Empire. And my thing is, you know what? Yeah, he's a little bit salty about the morality system. But you know what? It's an amazing story, and the twist is so good. And there's been articles written about that twist. Here's the thing. I saw the twist sort of coming with KOTOR, you know, that entire, you are Revan, and, you know, I don't care about that twist because it's a lame twist. But in this one, it's like, holy shit, it played with your expectations. And when you play the game again, you say, oh, okay, so that's why he had me do this and why he did that. You know, it is so carefully constructed. Getting back to Mass Effect, one of the twists in Mass Effect 2 is that the Geth are... the Geth you fought in the first game are heretics, and the real Geth just want to be left alone. And I thought that was an ass pull until I played Mass Effect 1 again, and then I saw the clues that Bioware was given. For example, there's one mission which you have to go to planet and defeat all of these Geth, right? When you complete that, a recording goes, and it's like a lone Quarian is singing and all that stuff, and you realize, oh shit, these Geth are regretting being with being the heretics. You know, they're apologizing to the true Geth out there beyond the Perseus Veil. And these little hints, you know, it's like, oh, I get it now. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'll never know what the twist in Jade Empire is because it wronged me and I'm petty.
Well, I'm going to tell you something.
But that's my point about how much I like Mass Effect is that it didn't punish me for it. It didn't punish you for taking your path, because the idea behind that game is that there is no wrong path.
Well, I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, it could affect you so long as you did other things, because the other thing that Mass Effect did were loyalty missions. I'll give you a hint. Now, go ahead.
You could still complete the game without those ultimate abilities. It's like Jonah was saying, he used the Jade Golem, so there are other paths to completing the game, and so long as the story is complete and whole, I think it's fine. You miss out on an ability, oh well, you know, you can still complete the game and
oh, no, it wasn't that. It's that I got to the point where you have the opportunity to learn those two abilities, and both the people were like, nah, fuck you, you didn't do it right. And
you know,
I was just like, well, I'm going to turn this game off and you stop existing. That's how I roll.
You know what? Both those abilities are so useless, it doesn't really matter. But here's the thing. I beg you to play the game again. You'll get to the point, and you know the point I'm talking – you'll know it when you get there, in which you're going to say, holy shit. When I first got to that point, when I first played it, my eyes widened. I said, what? Wait, what? I was that shocked. And it's sort of like, oh, wait a minute. It was so good. It was much better than the revelation that you're revving. Now, getting back to Mass Effect – you didn't – if you decided not to become all Paragon and all Renegade, it didn't penalize you in a way that if you did other stuff. Now, in the game, there were loyalty missions, and I think this is the game that introduced that concept of having loyalty missions. You know, after that, BioWare went nuts with loyalty missions with Dragon Age Origins and all that stuff. But at one point, you go to Verimier, and Rex is pissed off because this Krogan scientist is finding the cure to the Genophage, but they're making all the people slaves to Saren, and you have to destroy the cure. And if you don't calm him down, he's going to get killed. either by you or by Ashley. Now, one way to do it is to have a high enough Paragon or Renegade. But what about Grey Shepherd? Well, if you're Grey Shepherd and you did his loyalty mission and you got his armor back for him, his family armor, you could talk him down that way, so you didn't have to be Renegade or Paragon to keep him.
Absolutely. And that's what I loved about that game, is that it didn't penalize me for making those decisions. We're like, you have to understand, Jade Empire, like, it's evil and it's good. We're so evil and so good that it was either sugary sweet or just like murder children. And there is a literal part where you're just like,
yeah,
throw this guy to the ghosts and let them haunt him for eternity. It's like, I don't want to do that.
Now, here's the thing. There is a moment in which they actually do the closed fist correctly, in which you have this slave girl, right? You do one thing in which you help her and, you know, you aid her in escaping, or you can just treat her like shit and say, you're my slave now. But the third option, which is a true closed fist option, is you give her a knife and say, okay, you know what? You go prove yourself. Go after that guy yourself. I'm not going to help you. Show how strong you are. You know, and that's what the closed fist was supposed to be, you know.
Yeah. And
everything else was just villainous evil.
Yeah, and Mass Effect was like, it gave you that opportunity to, like, even if you're doing, like, the aggressive end, it's all with the sense that you're still doing this to save the galaxy.
I think that is the one thing that bothers me about Jade Empire, is that the East doesn't view good and evil like the West does. So closed fist and open hand weren't supposed to be good and evil. You know, maybe just more aggressive and passive paths and not necessarily, or chaos and order and not necessarily evil and good.
But you know what? I think it was more like they were still finding their way. I mean, you had KOTAR, in which, you know, light side, dark side options were very stark. You know, and they tried to do something a little more morally ambiguous, and they sort of failed with Jade Empire. They got it more with Mass Effect, knowing that you couldn't really have evil and good in a game that's, you know, that's a space romp. Instead, we'll make it you're either you what's it called? You're optimistic or you're nihilistic, you know. But the thing is that I will notice that the second game and the third game had a lot more humor in it than the first game. The first game was more adventure. The second and third games did a lot of lampshading, and there was a lot of the humor was in that, you know. Because now everybody knew who Shepard was. And The second game was when you went to the migrant fleet. Damn it, it wasn't in the first game. Oh well, never mind. Because that was the one in which you did the loyalty mission for Tali, and what's it called? At one point, you know, don't ask him about the name of the ship. Don't ask him, and you ask him in the name of the ship, and she says, "Oh boy, here we go," and she facepalms. So, anyways, the music, and you know, I love the ending of Mass Effect 1. You know, in which he, you know, they think he's dead. Of course he's not going to be dead, but the way he comes up and he just stands on the rubble, it's like a hero shot, and then he comes down smirking as he limps back to his friends. It's just such a perfect moment. But one last thing about Mass Effect is that it was an homage to the 1980s science fiction movies. And by the way, Mass Effect 2 was 1990s, and Mass Effect 3 was the aughts. And you know how you knew it was an homage to the 1980s, 1980s science fiction movies? It ends with a hair band ballad at the end. I said, yeah, that's basically it, you know. The score is by Jack Wall, by the way, and he did it as an homage to Blade Runner and other Vangelis stuff, you know, and you could tell.
Yeah. Like, easily one of the most stirring soundtracks out there, as far as, like, not just one game, but the whole series. It's had a lot of good music in it.
Yeah. Last thing is that Microsoft sold the rights to Mass Effect to EA, or at least, I'm sorry, BioWare became a property of EA, and EA published Mass Effect 2 and 3, and they could not do Mass Effect 1 for the PlayStation for a very long time, because that was still Microsoft's property. So at some point, EA had to beg them, listen, we want to do a Mass Effect trilogy. You know, because they did that stupid choice thing, you know, that little interactive comic for so that you could make the major choices of Mass Effect 1 for Mass Effect 2. But it wasn't the full, you know, it wasn't all the choices. It was just the major, major six or seven choices. So EA begged Microsoft, and you know the deal they made was, okay, you can have Mass Effect 1 for the Mass Effect trilogy, but you got to give us exclusivity on Titanfall. And that's eventually what happened. So Microsoft had their one big exclusive title for the Xbox One, which was very important. I mean, Titanfall, the first Titanfall was okay, but the fact that it was an exclusive made people's eyes raise, and it sort of took the, you know, it sort of helped the Xbox One when it could have tanked thanks to Microsoft's questionable business decisions on it, which they wisely did a 180 on, you know, like always on. No. So Titanfall saved the Xbox One, and in turn Mass Effect 1 saved the Xbox One, you know, when you follow that path. Anyways, we're going to move on to game news. After the fall update, development on Battleborn will cease, and this comes to us from PC Gamer. Battleborn has suffered since developer Gearbox released it, suffering from confusing messaging on what the game was exactly, called an FPS hobby-grade co-op campaign, genre-blended, multi-mode, competitive esports, meta-growth, choice, plus epic Battleborn Heroes, which was actually what was called by the studio. Whereas it dealt with a strong competition from Overwatch. That struggle is over, however, as development ceases. Gearbox is never able quite to fit in MOBA, is being retired, and will live the rest of its days being maintained by a small team. According to creative director Randy Varnell in a letter to the community, as of this week, there will be no more battle plans, and there will be currently no planned content after the fall update. Details of any future changes or news will be made on our forums or through social media, so keep your radars on. Once the fall update drops, Battleborn will quote-unquote continue for the foreseeable future, but it'll essentially be in maintenance mode. Varnell added, I've been working on Battleborn nearly exclusively since 2012, and in some ways that work stretches back to 2009 for me. It's been a long labor of love with many of my good friends at Gearbox, and I'm proud to have shared that journey with you, our community. Your spirit and loyalty have been a constant inspiration to the team at Gearbox. To thank the community, Gearbox is giving away a code that will net you a free skin for Deonde, redeemable until October 2nd. Wow, a free skin. So, yeah, Battleborn was always seemed like a Reddit stepchild in the series. And the problem is, the problem with all of Gearbox's games, just too cheesy. And here's the thing, I did not like, I forgot the name of it. How can I forget the name of their major FPS?
Borderlands.
It's not interesting, it's memorable, it's like...
I've never been a fan of Borderlands, and Battleborn was basically Borderlands, but as a arena shooter.
Battleborn is one of the victims of timing. I've talked about this with Titanfall 2 and how like Titanfall 2 could have had a much better outing if it hadn't released literally between the weeks that that Battlefield 1 and Call of Duty Infinite came out. Battleborn sits in a similar situation with Overwatch. If Battleborn hadn't come out and it was announced alongside and came out alongside Overwatch, it could have done so much better. But it had the unfortunate place of always being compared to Overwatch, always being put up against that, and it was never going to overcome what Blizzard was doing with Overwatch.
I don't think it was any good either. I mean, you could forgive a lot of things, but not being good, it was a mediocre effort. I mean, there are so many ways they could have been better with that game, but they went with the old Gearbox method of just being half-assed, you know, and that's my complaint about Gearbox all the time. Even their best games, you know, like Half-Life Opposing Force, it's a great story, but the gameplay is sort of half-assed, you know? I'm saying Borderlands was a half-assed game. I don't care how many people liked it. I felt it was reed thin, you know, for what it was. It could have been so much better.
Borderlands 2 is the best Gearbox game to have ever come out. That one was like, I think that was the best effort that they've ever put forth. I think it was like the most complete experience that they've ever done from gameplay to actual storytelling.
Only if you were playing co-op. As a solo game, it still sucked.
I would have to agree. I mean, like, it is not fun to play through a Borderlands game by yourself. They're good at creating experiences that you get together with your buddies, and you make a whole night of it. And Borderlands 2 was the finest example of that. I have not played Battleborn. To speak to what that first bullet point was, I have no idea what that game is about. All I know is ever since day one, it was compared to Overwatch, and it was never going to overcome what Overwatch was doing.
But here's the thing. You know, Paladins is another game that suffered from really bad timing, but it still has a huge fan base, despite being another game of the Overwatch ilk. You know, I mean, it's still in early access, yeah. But still, I mean, people like it, and people are playing it. Battleborn, you know, everything goes back to gameplay, you know? It didn't hit that Counter-Strike thing, you know? Counter-Strike is the game that I put as the gold standard for, do you want to play the same map again and again and again and again and again? You know, let's do Dust, let's do Dust, let's do Dust, let's do Dust, you know? That is it may not have as many players because it's an older game, but it also shows how to make an addictive arena shooter. And I don't think Battleborn had that let's play again sort of vibe. Not for me, and not for a lot of people, you know. I mean, there it does have a fan base, or else it would have shut down a lot longer ago, but I don't know. It just didn't have that kind of, okay, let's do another in this arena sort of thing.
And they're not the only ones. Gigantic is another one that was announced around the same time. I mean, you mentioned Paladins, but Gigantic they came out of early access fairly recently. They're finally. It's not a bad game. I've played it. It's pretty actually enjoyable. But they just laid off that studio just laid off a huge amount of its staff, and there's a lot of speculation as to whether Gigantic will survive that.
Well, here's the thing. The other thing about Gigantic, though, is it's different. You know, it has a different gameplay mechanic than the other games, in which you actually have two giant characters that you're trying to fight and protect and all that stuff. The jury's still out on Gigantic, and I don't, you know, when you hear about layoffs, you think, well, how many of them were contract workers? You know, Gearbox is not an unknown developer. You know, they were the ones who did Halo for the PC. They are the ones who did Half-Life Opposing Force. They're the ones who did Borderlands. You know, and they also, well, they picked up the work for Duke Nukem Forever too, but we're not going to talk about that. But they're the ones, they have a lot, you know, more of a cachet in the community. You know, I mean, even Paladins has High Res. They're the guys who did Tribes. So, it's,
yeah.
Like I said, you know, this isn't some third unknown developer coming in and making a game. This is Gearbox, you know, and there were expectations because, like it or not, Borderlands has a huge fan base, you know, and this is supposed to be their coming out party in the arena MOBA.
Yeah. I just think that when you have to set up against a mountain of a title like Overwatch, no one else is going to look good, especially if you have anything similar going on to that. Battleborn may have suffered from its gameplay, but it especially suffered from being beside something that was so good as Overwatch is. Because, I mean, Rainbow Six Siege...
Well, that's another. I was about to bring that up. Rainbow Six stumbled out of the gate really badly, and there were people who didn't think it was going to survive its first 6 months. But they just, you know, quality went run through. You know, people liked the gameplay. You know, and they said, okay, it's a little bit grindy, but that's fine. We're going to grind. And now, you know, it built up the fan base, and it kept on growing, which you haven't had your interview with the lead designer yet, but I'm pretty interested to see what he's going to say about that.
Yeah. So that's something I'm going to bring up. Like, what is it like to come out alongside that? What's it like to have to overcome, like, and compete with that it can't be easy. It can't be easy at all, especially if, like we're talking about here, especially if you're not up to snuff.
One of the good things, though, is that this is not a MMO, so this is not a game, you know, at some point they'll just say, okay, you know, free to play, and you if you run your own servers, you know, just here, you can do it yourself, you know. At some point, it's going to reach that point in which, you know, we're not going to make anything new for it. It's going to reach that point, but at least they'll still have that game, which is nice. I mean, I wish they would be able to do that. I don't know why these companies think they don't want to allow a City of Heroes independent firms, because what if we want to make another City of Heroes and people are playing it for free? They're not going to want that. No. It's such so stupid, you know? You only build your – I'm sorry. We're getting way off track here. I'm just thinking about defunct MMOs and how people can't play defunct MMOs anymore, even if they really invested a lot of time in it. And I know that's one of Scott's bugaboos, and I know that's one of Paul's bugaboos.
This is very unfortunate when you can't show a game to someone. I remember looking at Good Old Games, and they have that Mist Uru, and –
You
can play it, but it's not quite the same because it was supposed to be an MMO, but now when you play it, there's nobody going to be around, so it might feel more like the single player Mist where everything just feels abandoned. But it would have been nice to have been there when it was an active community, and you could interact with people in that world. But at least you could play it, so there is that.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
All right. Let's see. Next item is, every Nintendo Switch may contain a hidden copy of NES Golf. This is from Ars Technica. Your Nintendo Switch may already have a fully playable NES game just sitting inside of it. The news has emerged from SwitchBrew.org, a depository of hacking and file system analysis for Nintendo's latest console. After a major dump of title names from the system's file system in July, users there discovered a title in the system named Flog. The site's original stub about Flog alleged that this title contained a fully fledged NES emulator, but it said nothing else. Saturday's Switch Brew update centers entirely around this mysterious Flog entry, and it insists that this is an emulator wrapped around a single NES video game, the NES version of Golf first launched in 1984. Flog, that's Golf backwards, if you didn't see that coming, according to poster Yellow 8, who previously created his own GitHub repository full of 3DS system exploits. This copy of NES Golf is just sitting on every Nintendo Switch console in the world, and it's been designed specifically for the Switch compatibility. Possible screenshots of emulator in action shown above even demonstrate Joy-Con golfing motion controls. No emulated NES game, even during the waggle-heavy Wii era, has ever officially supported modern control updates like motion control or touchscreen controls. Nintendo says that its upcoming online service will add online support for NES, classic NES games, but it hasn't announced motion control upgrades or other gameplay additions to classics. Yellow 8 claims the emulator-wrapped game is installed on Switch systems, dating back to the system's original 1.0 firmware. The user also writes that it's unknown what exactly triggers launching this title. Could there be a button combo, Joy-Con motion command, or even amiibo-driven unlock required? Or is this a hidden proof-of-concept virtual console fair soon to be officially launched? I think that's the option, in my opinion. They probably have it locked and then unlock it once it's actually purchased or whatever. How exactly did Yellow 8 get the screenshots if the user couldn't load the hidden Switch game manually? There's certainly the possibility that this is a prank or a fake, but that's quite the long con based on the user's posts and active history on Switch Brew or other Nintendo hacking depositories. I mean, it certainly would be good for them to release these games and put them on the Switch, and I know that there's capability of doing it. It's just whether they want to do it.
I can give you another thing. It's probably a test program that they have on the system that was never intended to be released. It was just used internally, And that's it. You know, it's not unlockable. You can only unlock it in a dev console or something, which would be sad. You know, it's just testing out the controls and testing out the with a classic NES game. And having an NES, having a golf game that's uses your Joy-Con as a motion controller makes perfect sense. You can just visually envision yourself holding it like a club and swinging through, you know. And golf, NES golf was actually kind of fun, and it does stand the test of time because it's very hard to screw up a golf game.
Yeah, I mean, like to a certain extent, I can see why they would use that for a test, just because it is a decent way to fiddle around with motion controls. It's a decent way to fiddle that around with like UI.
And how many kilobytes does it take up? Like 8?
2. I would imagine 2.
It was the Atari 2600 that had 8K to play with, and only 2K of that was available. So I'm pretty sure it's something like 16K that could fit on an NES card. Something like that. I could always check it. But it's vanishingly small, and you could have it on a system just to check it, which, by the way, makes a lot of people annoyed because they're charging $5 to download these 6K software things onto a system.
Yeah, and I mean, like, how long have we been talking about Nintendo Online? When are they actually going to release that? Because it's been a while.
Yeah, so Nintendo cartridges was 64 megabytes. 6 megabits, I'm sorry. 6.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so the games are small enough. I mean, and there's no physical reason to me that they can't do this when I've seen people put together their own homebrew stuff. I mean, there's a NES Classic you can buy that has like 500 games on it, and I mean, it's doable. It's just whether they want to, and it doesn't seem like they want to.
I can envision if this was Microsoft or Sony saying, oh, by the way, there's a game on your console, and here's the code to unlock it. Enjoy! That's free PR, but we know Nintendo. No, they're like misers. They gotta hold on to control of every 4K game with, you know, like it's a gold, you know, even the crappy ones.
Yeah, Nintendo doesn't know how to do PR as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Divinity Original Sin 2 boasts over 75,000 concurrent players on Steam from PC Gamer. Despite a rocky launch involving a power outage, Divinity Original Sin 2 quickly claimed
top spot. I don't know why that's their little error. So that's top spot.
Despite a rocky launch involving a power outage, Divinity Original Sin 2 quickly claimed a top spot on Steam. Yesterday, another milestone was reached. Last night, it boasted the fourth highest number of concurrent players on Steam, with only PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, Counter-Strike, Global Offensive, and Dota 2 having more at the time. According to a sweet...
That should be tweet.
According to a tweet by developer Sven Vinkel... Sven Vink. It's very cool, but we've never seen this for one of our games, so we weren't prepared for it at all. It peaked at 75,429 concurrent players playing yesterday evening. While that still puts it far off the astronomical player numbers of the top three, it's comparable to other huge games like Grand Theft Auto V and Team Fortress 2. As PC Games N pointed out, this makes it one of the strongest launch titles for a CRPG, beating out the first Original Sin in Obsidian's Pillars of Eternity. They boasted a concurrent player peak of 22K and 42K respectively. The actual number will undoubtedly be higher as well, since this is just taking into account users on Steam and not those playing through GOG's platform. And that's great. That's pretty great for Original Sin. I mean, you don't often see those kinds of numbers on an RPG like that.
And, you know, Larian, who's a developer, it's been funny watching Larian go, because they're one of the shining examples of what Kickstarter can do for a title. You know, I mean, they started the series. It seemed dead in the water because none of the publishers would pick it up, and they say, you know what? Let's put it on Kickstarter and see if the players want it. And you know what? They got like what, four times their request amount for the first Original Sin. I'm trying to remember which one it was that they put on Kickstarter first, and then all of a sudden, there's a market for Divinity. You know, I mean, I think it was actually one of the influences that told Obsidian, you know what, go ahead with your isometric RPGs because people want this.
Yeah, it definitely was, and it is completely out of the ordinary. Obviously, this is what people want, and we're seeing people vote with their dollars. But at the same time, it's awesome to see this level of reaction from the community, because you do see this with Grand Theft Auto. You do see this with like Friday the 13th, because there's a lot of fans out there that love the horror movies. But like to see this with like a straight up isometric RPG, to see a player base this alive in 2017,
and it's also fantastic. Let's remember that this is an original IP. Well, not anymore, because they've made a bunch of games of Divinity. But originally, it's not Grand Theft Auto. It's not Dota. It's not Team Fortress. You know, the Divinity Original Sin is not a quote unquote name in the traditional sense. This is Larian, a small developer who is making it big. You know, and it's a nice little rags to riches story.
Yeah.
Thrilling. Oh, it makes me happy because I've always enjoyed the isometric RPGs, and seeing Divinity succeed like this and Pillars even, it's been really great, and I'm looking forward to playing both the sequels of Divinity Original Sin and the Pillars 2 game coming out as well.
Yeah.
Have you guys played the Divinity games?
Yes. I have.
Okay. So, Scott, you first, your impression of it.
I really loved it. This was one of the first games where the isometric got reactive with the environment, where you could use barrels to light oil slicks, or you could use ice to freeze water, or lightning to electrify the water. So it added more depth to combat, and battles that seemed like you were overwhelmed could suddenly turn to your side if you took advantage of the environment and your surroundings to make it a fair fight, or you know, just make it easier on yourself. And then there was the character development, where you select how your character views the world, and that gives you attribute points to, like, let's say near the beginning, there's this, you find out, you hear the story about a guy who jumps off of a cliff because of his faith or whatever, and your characters can either take the view of that, you know, religious faith, you have to take a leap of faith thing, or logic, well, that guy was stupid. And then later on, that you'll have a point to those things like faith or logic. So if you want to have a argument with a character and you have a point to that attribute, it'll help win that option if you want to, like, get something out of another character or an NPC.
TJ?
So it really good game.
One of my favorite isometric RPGs in the modern day has been Tyranny, for just, like, how that is out of Obsidian as well, for how much they play around with, like, the evil guy RPG. But the reason I bring that up is that I've played through Original Sin, and I can see how much Tyranny borrowed from that. Like, you get that same option that Scott was just...
I'm picturing you putting up your finger quotes there, borrowed.
Yeah. I think about that option that Scott was just talking about. At the very beginning of Tyranny, you get that thing where, like, you decide what background you come from, whether you were a scholar or a... Mm-hmm. Or a survivor of the Colosseums, and that provides like a skill check option and dialogue where it gives you that extra option to how you react to things, and it's really cool to see that like Tyranny, that like Larian Studios and Obsidian are in that camp and they're bouncing off of each other. They know that this stuff is cool and they're looking to each other. They see how much this works.
You're leaving out in Exile there. I mean, Brian Fargo. I mean, if anybody's what's it called? In Exile and Obsidian are really bouncing off each other. See all the opposite posts about Wasteland on the Pillars of Eternity, Kickstarter, and vice versa. So, yeah.
And Bard's Tale.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's sort of a community among the developers.
I was going to get there, too. It's not just Obsidian and Larian. People will see this. People will see 75,000 users at one time for Divinity, for Original Sin 2. And developers will be either reaffirmed or reignited to see that yes, this is a genre that people still love to play, and they'll continue to put that dedication into it. It's awesome.
And by the way, let's not gloss over the fact that it mentioned Pillars of Eternity has 45,000 concurrent users, which isn't exactly peanuts either.
Absolutely. Like it bodes well for Wasteland 3. It bodes well for Planescape. Tides of Numenera. It bodes well for a lot of different games like this because we still love playing these games.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm still looking forward to Cyberpunk 2077 whenever that's coming out. And by the way, all indications are it's going to make Witcher 3 look like a NES game in terms of size. So that we have that going. I mean, there is a renaissance of RPGs, in all flavors now. I mean, it's not all first-person RPGs like Fallout and Elder Scrolls, you know, because people want, you know, variety, you know. And one of the things about them all helping each other is they know that these people aren't going to, you know, say, oh, I play Divinity, I'm not going to play Pillars of Eternity because I'm a Divinity. No, they don't have that kind of fanboy thing. With this style of game, all isometric RPGs. They don't have a favorite in terms of which IP they prefer over others. It's like we like them all.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If I'm a developer working on Wasteland 3 right now and I'm looking at this story, the thought going through my mind is F yes.
also, there's another thing too, is that the bar has raised. We better make this good. Because here's the thing, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that guy who said, oh yeah, that's the one game that's bad. Because here's the thing, when you have developers pushing each other, they also push each other to be better.
Well, that's the spirit of competition right there. They push each other to be better and not just, you know, spitefully, but to, you know, to succeed all together and make a good product for the fan base that is clearly there.
Well, it's in their best interest to keep fans of that genre and bring in new fans. Mm-hmm. Because it isn't just the people like you who says, oh, yeah, it's an isometric RPG, you know, it's probably going to be, you know, I've been following it all that, you know, it's a new user, you know, it's sort of like getting that 16-year-old, oh, what is this, Divinity, Original Sin 2? Okay, let me try it, you know. Because the word of mouth, you know, there's a lot of people playing it, and that always leads to more people playing it. And it can only be good for that genre. Hopefully they pace it out. And that's one of the good things about this being sort of independent, sort of kinda, is that they're not gonna. They may make sequels, but they're not gonna milk it, you know, like Assassin's Creed. Just keep releasing one every year until people get deathly sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta see Larian and I'm gonna check the release dates of each of these games, and I'm gonna willing to bet you they're all 2 or 3 years apart.
Oh yeah, they did the original Sin a few years back, and then they did an HD version of it.
Okay, so here's the thing: Divine Divinity, which is the first game in the series, came out in 2002. Beyond Divinity came out in 2004. Divinity 2 Ego Draconis came out in 2009. Divinity 2, which I think is an expansion, 2010. Then the next Divinity came out in 2013. Divinity Original Sin came out in 2014. The Enhanced Edition 2015. Obviously, it's just. And Divinity Original Sin 2 came out 3 years later in 2017. So they are spacing it out.
Which is good, because, I mean, there is such a thing as franchise fatigue.
And they also did educational games, too. I love it when you find games that you didn't know were made that by that people. Like, I saw I'm going to lose myself now. Hold on. There was a game. So you know who developed the first PC? Although it wasn't a PC, it was an Amiga game. The first Mech Warrior game. It was developed by Westwood and published by Infocom. Wrap your head around that one for a bit. It was an Infocom RPG. Yes, the people who mastered the text adventure game released the first Mech Warrior RPG. Just thought I'd throw that out there. You never know who's going to be developing these games. Anyways, I think I should wrap this up now. Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave some iTunes comments. I am at Jonah Falcon on Twitter.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
I am at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Play games, have fun, and be cool.
And also, we're proving why 2007 is considered one of the best years for video gaming ever. Because the next week's game, you might have heard of it. I will give you a not-so-subtle hint. Master Chief.
Nice.
And that is it. Okay, bye-bye.